extensive archive.
This is the first time during this particular edition of Augusta that there's been a group discussion. And I want to tell you that this Folk Tales and Tellers discussion group is funded by the Humanities Foundation of West Virginia. And I hope that, particularly if you have fun tonight, that you'll come tomorrow night to the lounge where we're going to do Keeping the Old Ways Alive. And I made notes to myself, and I'll tell you that the reason I did that is I want to be real efficient. I want to say everything that I need to say and get out of the way of these storytellers. And what I want to do is hopefully lay just a little bit of groundwork for what's going to happen tonight. The Humanities Foundation is interested in something like what it means to be a human being. And having given that question some thought, it occurs to me that it means, among other things, the following. The ability to create a work of art, and then the ability to appreciate it after you've done so. The ability to have a sense of humor, the ability to fall in love, and the ability to be self-conscious. And by self-conscious, I don't mean, oh, my fly's undone. All of that certainly.
Although it may be so. Although it's undone.
My fly's on, but it's always good to check. I mean by that the ability to reflect on yourself and to think about yourself. And so the question that occurs to me immediately, but it's a rhetorical question, do not answer, okay? Is if I were to ask you, why are you here? The very obvious answer is that everybody likes to hear a good story. And I believe that's true, and I also believe it's true that everybody likes to tell a good story. Even if you think maybe you don't like to tell stories. My guess is, my intuition is that when you get a good audience, and when you get a good story, that you really like to do that. The question why, Margot Blevins, everybody knows Margot. She's the lady who, the glue that keeps things together here. You can always tell a good administrator. They're the people at the top that are always concerned with the things at the bottom, you know, like going out to get ice or, you know, who didn't turn on the electricity or something like that. Margot said the other night that the Humanities Foundation was interested not in the who and the what so much as it is in the why. And so the question, why are you here? Well, if we ask that question over and over, and we ask ourselves, why do we like stories? My answer would be that they are expressions of self. Now, I was given I'm a guy who recognizes a great phrase to steal when I hear it, okay? And I was talking with a lady, Terry Deal Reynolds, today, who was describing people in terms of having inner landscapes. When I like that, see, that's very visual, and I like that. And I wonder what my own inner landscape coming from the flat woods of Florida must look like. Oh, there he is. He's always the same. And so now, after having heard that phrase, I would say that the tales that we tell each other are reflections of our inner landscape as they relate to our outer landscape, or as I would have said it before today, the relationship between person and place. So you're going to hear a lot of good stories tonight, and I know that that's what a lot of you came from. But I also invite you to be reflective, and of course I've invited all of our speakers to be reflective and to talk about the context of values that these stories come out of. Things like who told them to them and why did they tell the story? How did the story function? What did the person mean to communicate by that story? What did it mean, as far as you can tell, to the person who told it, and what does it mean to you? Why did you keep that story? What's good about that story for you? So I would say that stories say a lot about the way individuals interact with their own cultures. And besides being entertained, we're going to think about that a little bit tonight. Now I'd like to introduce you to Jimmy Costa. Jimmy Costa is the man that I have come to know. As the fellow who can immediately become the Appalachian guru to a bunch of French students. And they follow him around all over the place now and tells weird stories. I met Doug Elliott tonight. I don't know anything about Doug except that he teaches a course in wood lore and herbs. And so I was looking around for a guy like gnawing the bark off trees and stuff. And sure enough, when I met him today, he had a backpack made out of bark. So I don't think you need to know any more about him than that. That's enough. Jim Glim is teaching the course, by the way, I didn't mention that Jimmy's teaching a course, and I can't say West Virginia repertoire.
Not
it
after the French people
funny.
Are here.
It sounds too funny. West Virginia repertory,
right.
where you teach many things that you know. Jim Glenn is teaching a course in storytelling, and I ran into him today. He had all of his students in the quilting class telling them stories while they were quilting. And I figure a guy like that can't be all bad, nor possibly all good.
Sorry, Martin.
So I'm going to encourage our presenters tonight to be their normal entertaining selves and to consider the values involved here. And we don't want any pedantry. Anybody starts talking about Freud, Jung, Adler, and Barry Sadler gets kicked out, right? Have at it, guys.
Very TV. Hey, well, how would you like to do that? What would you like to do?
You put me on this one, huh?
Well, let's see. A lot of my life is involved in the natural world. And one of the more awkward situations in a storytelling situation is how do you start? And I noticed Jimmy was real gracious about this. Hey, Doug, why don't you, what do you want to say?
I did it first last night.
So in my context, let's see, I have a story, and I like this story because it's sort of a restatement. I mean, it is sort of to us what, to most 20th century Americans, it is to us, one of the most basic as far as stories. And yet, when reworked, it has a sort of several other levels of existence. And this story is about a story of drama, and a story of intrigue and suspense, and a story of breaking and entering and petty thievery. This is a story about a ravishing blonde-haired young woman, and a somewhat dramatic and tumultuous encounter she had with the natural world. And it goes something like this.
Well, once upon a time in a nursery rhyme, there were three bears. I said, once upon a time in a nursery rhyme, there were three bears. Now, first it was a papa bear.
And then there was a mama bear.
Then there was the wee bear.
Well, one day through the woods come a walking, a stalking, a gawking, a talking.
A little girl with pretty curls, and her name was Goldilocks, and on the door she knocked.
She walked right in, had herself a ball, just a eating and a sleeping and a rocking and all. Now just listen to old Goldilocks just having a ball. I'm going down to the Three Bears land, old Goldie gonna take me by the hand. Home, 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 come the three bears. Some of us been eating my porridge. Said the papa bear.
Some of us been eating my porridge. Said the mama bear.
Beep, got a wee bear, stuck a little wee bear in my bowl. There ain't nothing there.
Well, some of us been sitting in my chair, said the papa bear.
Some of us been sitting in my chair, said the mama bear.
Beep, bop, wee bear, said the little wee bear, someone has broken my chair.
Well, Goldilocks, she woke up, that party and beat it on out of there. Ba-ba-ba, said the papa bear.
Ba-ba-ba, said the mama bear.
Mama, I said to Mama Bear. Beep, bop, wee bear, says a little wee bear, Mama.
That's the story of Holy Life. Holy Life.
Well, that's great. That's great. There's the little one over there. Well, I think I'll tell some of the things that I tend to somewhat collect and use in my everyday life, and that is, in fact, I did it unconsciously for years until I realized that old expressions and sayings in the area of West Virginia where I come from, my people in southern West Virginia, all the people down in the area that I have befriended and relatives and all, I realized somewhere in about the middle of my life that there's a unique thing going on here which is called expressions and old sayings. People would use these than rather to go on and on with words to try to get something across to you verbally. They would just these expressions and sayings were created to leave no doubt in one's mind what was being said at the moment. And normally they're short and sweet, and I love those. So through the years, I even used them myself, not realizing the uniqueness in them. And then I finally did, and I thought, well, I'm going to actively collect these as I talk with people. Not solicit them, but just in my everyday life of working in a small store and customers coming in and conversing with people, natural conversation. And set them in my head and then also set them on paper because they got so overwhelmed by numbers I couldn't even think to remember them all. So I'll share some with you and some of the incidents that these expressions came forth. I was talking with a neighbor one time of mine, and she had just had a bad day all the way around about. When she had gotten up, things hadn't gone right and she couldn't find this and couldn't find that, and I said, Well, just what's it been like for you today? She said, I'll tell you, she said, I've just been mixed up like a termite in a yo-yo. You can see an old wooden termite. Yeah, you know, mixed up like a termite in a yo-yo. And this is one that I used to spend a lot of time, this was probably in the mid-60s from about 19... Well, actually, the early 60s through it's about 1964 and 5, I was in my late teens. And my best friend's grandfather had this phenomenal, huge farm, was a farmer all of his life, and we would stay a couple of weeks at a time with them. It was a very rural community. There was a couple of churches. You'd go down, you'd walk about a mile from their house, which was up this beautiful hollow with a great big creek that meandered parallel with the dirt road that went up to their home. And we'd walk down that road and go over to Green Sulphur Springs where the post office was. It's yet there in the old store and all. And we would go in the store pretty often. If we were staying there a couple of weeks, we'd go over there every 2 days and trade eggs. Mr. Kales did a lot of bartering with the storekeeper, mainly eggs. So we were over there one time, and these old fellas were gathered up around the store. It was in the fall of the year, I think, as I recall. And Lester Duncan asked Clarence, my old friend who is now 94 years old, said, Clarence, he said, I just never could understand how a fella like you, as rough looking as you were, even when you were young, how you ended up with such a pretty wife as Molly. Said she was just as pretty as a speckled pup when she was a young woman. And Clarence looked at Lester and he said, well, I'll tell you, Lester, he said, I've studied about that a lot, put a lot of thought into it. And he said, I've just come to figure it out. He said, love's just like lightning. He said, it's just as apt to hit a castle as it is an outhouse. these are things, some of these I've never heard before or since. You know, they're maybe the individual itself cooked it up. And some other ones, you know, somebody will say, well, how cold was it? Or it was so cold, or it was so hot. Now, I have a lot of those people. I heard a fellow say one time, I'm having a bad year, drought, you know, no water, no rain. And the old fellow said, he said, I'll tell you, he said, it's been so dry, I seen two trees a-fighting over the same dog.
You're talking good eye.
Yeah. And as far as a windy day, you know, now this one I heard just about a year ago in a barber shop. The fellow I go to the barber to, that is my barber's brother, was in one day, and he was telling about getting all this old cut rock from a foundation of a house. And they were up on this big knoll, big knob where the old house had stood, and it was really windy that day. And he said, I'll tell you, David, he said, it was so windy we couldn't load rocks. And you could just, you know, just couldn't load rocks. James, entertain us with something here.
Well, I've been being entertained. It just reminds me of the coldest I ever saw it was up in Blossburg, Pennsylvania, where I live. I live in Williamsport, but one morning I was going to work and I saw two beagles, and they had jumper cables on a rabbit trying to get him started. lest we stray from the humanities, National Dam for Humanities purpose of this evening, I thought that it would be appropriate to talk for a few minutes about how I got started collecting folklore. Some people have called what I do fake lore. But anyway, I grew up on Long Island. You've heard of Long Island? My father is still a practicing attorney in New York, and on Long Island, there really is no nature to speak of. The closest thing you can get to nature is a golf course. And so my father decided when I was about 16 years old that I needed to be toughened up. What he did was he arranged through a bunch of friends and associates to send me up to work on the Trans-Canadian Railroad. I don't even remember Alberta, Saskatchewan, someplace way, way far out. And I got up there by train and by plane and by hiking, and finally I got there and I got into this railroad camp, and I was a greenhorn. But they gave me this long, I gotta stand up to do this. I mean, I'm used to telling stories standing up. This isn't a banjo story, but it's a true story. And they gave me this long metal bar, they called it an Irish banjo. Now they told me I was a Gandy dancer. Gandy dancer is somebody who goes along the railroad straightening ties and straightening rails with this long metal bar, and you kind of walk along and you pry it. I can see that some of you have been Gandy dancers. You're going like this, and you straighten the bar. And I was in my glory because I'd never seen the wilds, and it was just great to be outdoors all day long. And you could look around, and you could see grizzly bear, and you could see moose. These great big moose with the antlers just so big, and every once in a while a deer would go by, and sometimes you might see an elk if you're near one of the game preserves. And oh, it was wonderful. Every day I'd go out there and see all this nature, and I was particularly impressed with the moose. And one night I came back, and this is how I got interested in folklore, how I collected my first piece of folklore in Canada. I came back one night, and I brought my plate up to the cook for dinner, and I held my plate out, and he reached in the pot, and he poured out the worst looking mess of food I ever saw in my life. It just was terrible looking. I brought it back to the table, and I put it down, and I said, and all the men were seated there, and I said, I'm not eating this slop. Well, all of a sudden, all the men just kind of looked at me. These great big railroad workers, this little punk kid from New York, they smiled. And then they all stood up and they grabbed me, and they started dragging me towards the kitchen. And as they dragged me towards the kitchen, I saw the cook coming out of the kitchen, taking off his apron. And that's when I learned my first piece of folklore. In a railroad camp, if you complain about the food, you have to be the cook. I wonder how that'd work in your houses if you tried that. Well, I come all this way to be out in nature, and I ended up being in the kitchen and cooking and slaving and started complaining about it getting mighty mean. Some of you know what I'm talking about. I thought, I'm not real bright, but I ain't real slow either. And I thought about this for quite a while. And finally, I got an idea. It's like a light bulb just went off in my head. And I realized what I had to do. I had to get somebody else to complain about the food. Then I'd get out of the kitchen. Next thing you do is come up with a meal. And finally, I hit upon something. Well, the next day I went into town because I could take the Jeep and go into town, and I got a whole lot. I got a big roast beef and potatoes and all kinds of wonderful things. And I also bought about 5 boxes of that there Betty Crocker pie crust dough mix, whatever you call it. I didn't really know how to bake, but I read the directions, I could read. And I brought it back home. I cooked the men a beautiful dinner, best I could. And I made this great big pie crust for them, about that, about the size of Pudgy's extra large pizza, about like that. Crimped up the edges real nice, like I'd seen my granny do. And then I put it in the oven on about 200 degrees, like I'd seen my grandma do. And then I went on down to the tool shed, because it was the middle of summer, and they got me a great big snow shovel. Then I went on out into the woods until I found what I was looking for. It didn't take long. A great big fresh moose turd. It's still warm, too. Oh, it had a little skin on the outside. It had a nice dimple right in the middle. And I used to play a little lacrosse, so it was nothing for me to just go right on down there and scoop that thing right up, cradle it on back into camp before the men got back, and slide it right into that pie crust. I knew somebody's going to complain about this here moose turd pie when they ate it. Well, I served them dinner and they ate it right down. We had this big Swede in the camp. They called him Big Ole. He was a bit of a hog and he always ate more and he ate faster than everybody else. And he just tore through dinner. He just tore through it. And he just had a huge appetite. And come dessert, I went on in there and got out that moose turd pie. And it looked just like a great big chocolate cream pie, just warm. Carried it out on there, put it right down in the middle of the table like that. Big Ole said, "You're just a big kitchen." He took out a great big buck knife and opened it up and just dove right into that moose turd pie. I knew that he was going to eat it and he was going to complain about the food. I knew I had him and I'd get out of the kitchen. I wouldn't have to cook ever again as long as I was up there. So he took a great big slice out of it, put it on his plate, took a great big forkful, put it in his mouth. And as he's chewing, this kind of, the only word I can use is a mystical look on the face. And then he swallowed it. And his eyes kind of crossed and he jumped up from the table and smashed his fist down on the table and everybody, he called everybody and said, "By golly, this is moose turd pie!" But it's good. That, by the way, is one of a very, very old traditional American folk tale told from before the Revolutionary War, where someone has served a disgusting pie. It's an old American folk tale. It's been collected all over the United States and Canada, and I collected it in Pennsylvania a few years ago.
So you stayed in the kitchen.
He's been in the kitchen ever since.
You know, there's some truth in that.
I think this falls on you.
I think it's back to me here. Let's see. Well, let's see. Let's see. This extemporaneous stuff, you know. So. I just thought of a couple of things. There's you're talking about these regional expressions. I was raised up on the western shore of Maryland, on the edge of the Chesapeake Bay, and the one of the expressions that I hear that came sort of from the environment from there, they used to say, "Yep, that house is shut up tighter than a crab's ass." I thought, well, now there's a colorful concept, you know. And not, you know. If you've ever tried to open crabs, you understand that. Well, let's see. I'm trying to think about which way to go on this.
I have a suggestion.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, you know, if you're
sure.
Sitting there. But something that occurred to me while I was listening is that I've run into some things,
family stories. Stories that I know that I'd heard the story that you told and, you know, in a different context. And with a less seamy or steamy language, I might add. But, good joke. But there are certain stories that that seem to be just found in certain families, and they're proud of their stories just like they're proud of their fiddle tunes. I wonder if you ever run across anything like this.
My grandmother used to tell my brother and I stories. She was an old Latin teacher and a Catholic, and she used to have a lot of these classic stories. And actually, what was most memorable from me to her, or from her to my brother and I, is that Grandma, tell us another story. She'd go, "Once upon a time, the goose drank rind, and the grasshopper jumped on a sweet potato vine. That's the end of storytelling time." You know, that's what you do to kind of wind things down. I'll pass it on. I bet some of you have some of that. Family, do you want to go on that theme?
Well, of course, the most famous American family is the Council Harmon family and the Jack Tales collected by Gilbert Chase. Jack Tales take a while to tell. I'll tell one if you...
Let your conscience be your guide.
Yeah, right.
Would you like to hear a Jack Tale? I'll speed it up. It's called Jack and the Doctor's Daughter. I just went out of tune.
You gotta move your mouth a certain way and it'll come into tune again. There you are, there you are.
That's not quite right, is it? Well, let's hear a story about Jack and the doctor's daughter. One day, Jack fell in love with the doctor's daughter, and he went on up to the doctor, and he asked the doctor if he could see his daughter. And the doc said, "Well, Jack, you're just a poor boy. How much money you got?" Jack said, "Well, I don't got no money at all." And he said, "Well, before you can see my daughter, you got to get you $1,000. Then you can see my daughter." And Jack said, "Well, might give it a try." So he went on home and talked to his mom, and she packed him a nice lunch and some Dr. Pepper and some Snickers bars and some peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, threw it in a knapsack, and he set off over the mountain. Went up one hill and down the other, and pretty soon it got dark, and pretty soon it started raining. It rained so much a trout was swimming by. It rained so hard people were jumping in the creeks to keep from drowning. And by and by, as it was pitch black, he saw a light way up in the distance. And he went on up there and he knocked on the door, and an old witchy lady come to the door and said, "What can I do for you, sonny boy?" He said, "Well, I'm just a poor, tired, hungry boy looking for a place to spend the night." She said, "This here's a robber's den. If you come in here and the robbers catch you, they'll kill you." Jack said, "I don't mind. Just want a place to sleep." So she took him on in and he fell asleep. She gave him a place to sleep on the straw, and wasn't too awful long later that robbers came by. And as they was dividing up their loot, they heard something in the background. It was Jack a-snoring. So they went on back there and started waking him up. An old lady said, "Don't wake him up just yet. I hate to see somebody killed in their sleep. Wake him up first and then kill him." So they woke him up and said, "Jack, boy, we're going to have to kill you." He said, "I don't mind, just so as I got some good sleep." And they said, "Jack, you seem like a clever chap. Are you a good hand at stealing?" He said, "Well, not really. I never did try it, but might give it a try if you give me a chance, if you let me live." And they said, "Well, we'll tell you what. There's a farmer, and he's got 3 oxen. And if you can steal 1 or 2 or 3 of them, we'll give you $300 apiece for them oxen. And you got to start tomorrow morning." So Jack said, "Well, we'll give her a try." So the next morning he got up real early and went on down the road and looked up and down the dirt road and was trying to figure out how he's going to steal an ox from this farmer, because they came one at a time. And he saw an old piece of rope lying by the side of the road. So he grabbed up that piece of rope and climbed up in a tree limb and hung on out over the road. And he wrapped the rope under his arms and then wrapped it up around his neck and hung himself from the tree in such a way that if you looked, it looked like he'd been hung by the neck, but really, he was just hanging there as comfy as could be under the arms. Well, by and by, that farmer come on down the road, and the first thing he said when he saw that poor boy hanging from a tree, he said, "Lord, them robbers done hung a boy from a tree. I better just tie my oxen to the tree here
go on back in town and get the sheriff. And that's what he done. Well, immediately he done that, Jack jumped on down from the tree, untied the oxen, and brought the oxen home. The robbers was mighty impressed. They said, Jack, boy, you're a good hand to steal. Now let's see if you can get that other oxen. So next morning he went on down to the road and he found a nice red lady slipper lying in the road. And he got himself an idea. He just left it laying right there. And by and by, farmer come on down the road and he saw the red slipper lying there. And Jack's lying in the bushes and he heard him say, well, there's a nice slipper. It'd be a good one for my wife, but there's only one of them. It ain't gonna do me no good to bring home one slipper. She'll just get mad. So what I'll do is I'll just leave it there and go on down the road. So went on down the road. As soon as he went on down the road, Jack come a running out of the bushes, picked up the slipper, run back in the bushes, and run on ahead of the farmer, put the slipper down in the road about a mile up the road. And when he got there, he saw the slipper. He said, Lord, there's other half that pair of slippers. Well, I'll just tie my oxen to the tree here and go on back and get the other half of that pair. And that's what he done. Of course, as soon as he done that, Jack untied the oxen and brought it up to the robbers. They was real impressed. That's 600. You're keeping track of this money here. That's $600. They said, Jack, if you can get that last ox, we'll give you $400. Then you'll have your $1,000. We'll see if you become kind of buddies at this point. So the next day, Jack got on up in a holler near the road. And when he saw the farmer coming by with his last and final prize ox, he started doing this up in the holler. And the farmer said, there's my oxen up in the holler. They ain't been stolen. They just wandered off up into the holler. I'll just tie my oxen to the tree here and go on up and get them. Well, Jack led him a merry chase up and down one hill and got them all tangled up in a swamp. And they ain't seen that farmer yet. Jack come a running on back, grabbed the last ox, come on home, got his $1,000, and started out for home and the doctor's daughter. When he got there, he said to the doc, Doc, I got here $1,000, and I'm hoping that I can see your daughter now. And the doc said, well, Jack, boy, you are a good hand to steal. People have been bragging you up quite a bit. But there's just one little bitty thing I want you to do to prove to me that you really are a good thief. Now, I'm going to put 12 men on 12 horses in the corral tonight, and they'll be riding around the corral. And what I want you to do, boy, is I want you to steal them 12 horses from mountain, them 12 men. If you can do that, you can see my daughter. Well, Jack went over there that evening and brought him a great big old jug of cider, and he sat down, and the men is going around on their horses. Stay away from us, Jack. Stay away from us. And it got mighty cold. You know how cold it can get in the mountains. And Jack sat making believe like he's sipping out of this cider jug, and by and by one of the men said, Jack, boy, give me a sip of that there cider. He gave him a sip, and then another one, and it had a sleeping potion in it. Pretty soon, all these men were sleeping riders, and Jack slipped them off the horse and took the horses, brought them home, and next morning him and his daddy and some of his brothers brought them up, and he said, Doc, here's your horses. Can I see your daughter now? He said, Jack, boy, you're a good hand to steal. There's just one little bitty more thing I want you all to do. We're having rabbit for dinner tonight. And what I want you to do is steal it out of the pot while we're sitting there looking at it, cooking. Jack looked in the night and said, well, I might give her a try. He went on home and snuck on back around supper time. Right up to the front porch he snuck. And he had two great big rabbits with him, both of them tied on strings. And he snuck up to the front porch. And the doc and the doc's daughter, his heavenly daughter, and his wife were sitting in there watching the rabbit boil in the pot, just bubbling and steaming. Jack snuck up onto the front door and he let one of these rabbits hop out on the porch. And as he hopped around on the porch, he'd pull it back. And then the doctor's daughter said, and she talked like this, Daddy, Daddy, there's a rabbit on the front porch. Mm-hmm. Quiet, daughter, don't pay it no mind. Well, then Jack let the big rabbit hop out on the front porch. And she said, Daddy, Daddy, there's an even bigger rabbit on the front porch. Well, the doc, he couldn't stand no more of this, and he said, come on, let's go get him. So they run out the front door, and Jack run around the back door, ran in the kitchen, grabbed a towel, grabbed a knife, ran up to the rabbit pot, stuck it in the rabbit pot, put it in the towel, and run home. Like one of them football players. Next morning, he come up to the doc, and he said, Doc, I want to see your daughter now. Can I see your daughter? The doc said, Jack, boy, you can see my daughter. You just got to do one more thing. You gotta steal a sheep from off in the bed me and my wife are sleeping on. You can do that and you can see my daughter. And if you try to come near my house, I'm going to keep a shotgun right by the window. And if you try to come near the house, I'm going to blow your fool head off. Well, that night, the dog and his wife were upstairs and upstairs bedroom getting ready to go to bed. And he had his loaded shotgun right by the bed. And all of a sudden, he heard a tremendous crashing on the outside window. His wife said, "It's Jack. He's trying to get in." "Jack, I'm warning you, get away from that window. I'll blow your head off." And he opened up the shade, and there was a figure of a man just banging against the window. Boom. Boom. He said, "Jack, I'm going to shoot you." And he picked up a shotgun. "I'm warning you, Jack." And let him have a tremendous crash they heard outside. They looked out, and whatever was there had fallen back on the ground. And his wife said, "You done killed Jack. You done killed him. You better go on outside and hide the body." So the doc run on downstairs, and he run outside. And weren't gone for just a second when a voice come from downstairs and said,
Oh, lady, I done killed Jack. I need something to wrap the body up in." "Well, what do you want?" "Oh, I'm just throw down that old sheet from the bed."
So she threw down the sheet from the bed. And a few minutes later, the doc come on back, walking inside, walking up the steps, and said, "That weren't Jack. That was just an old scarecrow out there. Jack must have been playing his tricks on us again." Then the wife said, "Well, I don't know what happened, but I just threw the sheet down the stairs. I thought it was you. It must have been Jack, and he got the sheet." Well, next day, Jack come on up to the doctor, and he said, "Doc, can I see your daughter now? Because if I can't see her, I'm going to the sheriff. I'm going to report an attempted murder on your part." "No, Jack, boy, you come on up. Come on, you can see my daughter. Why don't you come for dinner tonight? We're having rabbit." And Jack did go up for dinner that night, and he did meet the doctor's daughter, and last I heard, they was getting along fine. James, what do you make of that story? A Freudian analysis. It has nothing to do with stealing. It has to do with the boy coming into manhood. If you want to get married, you better have the means for providing survival on the farm, oxen. You better learn how to use your head. You better learn how to have food, which you need for dinner. You better learn how to keep the livestock in the barn. It's all the elements in this story about essential things that you need to live on a farm, including a happy marriage.
Have you ever thought about this before?
Lots of times. Folklore teachers have to think about these things.
Right, I understand. Now, I'd never heard of the family. I don't know these things. So I'd never. What is the family that this story came from?
It's the Council Harmon, the Harmon family down in, I believe it's North Carolina. Mm-hmm. They had a cycle of stories that they told in the family. And the Jack Tales is a very popular Appalachian book, as well as the Grandfather Tales, collected in sort of written up by Gilbert Chase. And they're actually relatives of the Jack the Giant. Jack the Giant Killer is one of the Jack Tales, and they're related to the English cycle of Jack Tales, mm-hmm. which are related to an ancient Hindu cycle of folk tales.
Yeah.
Well, we said we weren't going to be pedantic.
Well, I didn't know enough to be pedantic at that point, so I let it go. Doug, do you have a lot of stories? I mean, do you have more than, say, 6 stories that you regularly tell?
Yeah.
Do you know why you collect them?
I think that some of my stories illustrate my work, which is teaching about nature. And what usually delights me about them is that they teach me or they display or celebrate another way of relating to the natural world. Mm-hmm. And anything that you're interested in, anything that you want to say, usually the most articulate way to, or the most impressive way to express it is through a story.
Yeah.
"You know, I went down to the store the other day, and you know what? And all of a sudden, you've got, you know, attention."
Oh yeah, I know. Today, when we were talking about what we're going to do here, you said something. These weren't your words; they're mine. But you said something about, like, "Don't give me the general theory. Give me an example."
Right. I really work on that way. I work on examples.
Yeah, and an example always works. Do you teach mostly kids or do you teach adults?
No, mostly adults.
And you find that stories works just as well, or maybe?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, I started telling stories as lecturing about medicinal and edible wild plants. Yeah. Well, you know, you can get a group that's interested in herbs or plants, and you start showing them pictures, and you get about 10th picture, and even if they're interested, you know, and but stories, they make it more alive to me. They make it more alive to everyone.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Will you do a story?
I'd like to talk about one thing that I've been really enjoying is this critter that's found sort of in every cow pasture and every wooded lot between Canada and North Georgia is nothing but the old groundhog. And not only these groundhogs, not only are they found in pastures and woodlots, but they're also found in soup pots and frying pans and home remedies and well, I should talk about that a little bit. One day, last fall, one of my neighbors comes around the side of the hill and I see him coming up to my house, and he's dragging something, and he comes in dragging a groundhog. He said, "Doug, I got you a groundhog." And they know that if somebody shoots something around in the area and they're not gonna deal with it, they just don't have any use for it. They know that usually I'll eat it just out of respect. And I just feel like to, you know, to take something, kill it, and throw it away. It's just, I just can't see it. So I have more meat than I really care for. But So I told him I was interested, and he says, "Now you ought to just take that hide. Now you save that hide." And I said, "Well, what would I do with that? Buddy, that makes the best old shoestrings you ever did see. It'll just, you just, well, how do I do that? Well, you just lay you some ashes in that pan, in a pan or something like that, and just lay some wood ashes in there with some water. Lay that old groundhog hide in there, and then that hair will slip right off of it." And he says, "Make you band your head too, although an old cat hide's better than that. You just get you one of them old barn cats. They're good for that." So I did that, and I did that. He says, "Then just take it over the back of a chair or something. Just work that thing till it's soft." And I did, and then I took it and cut it in a little circle and a circle and a circle until I got these long thongs, and they're very, very strong. In fact, I even put them on my dress shoes. If any of you ever want to come later after the performance to see my groundhog hide shoelaces, they work great, and I just don't imagine there's any better shoelaces in the world. I haven't seen it, And he said, now don't forget to take that grease now. Now render that grease out. You save every bit of that." "Oh yeah, what'll I do with that?" He says, "Well, now you just take that grease," and he says, "and you render that right out, and just take that, and that'll be good for the croup. If you ever get a cough or the croup," he says, "you just take you a spoonful of that, buddy." He says, "Now there's things that tasted better, but it'll help you, buddy. It'll help you." And I started around the neighborhood, started talking about, you know, finding about groundhogs, because here's this animal that I've had them in gardens before. It's a varmint. Boy, you get one in your garden, and they just tear up that garden. Somebody just told me today that a groundhog caused her $300 in damage in her car. A groundhog somehow got a real hankering for the hoses and just kept chewing up water hoses, and I mean she told me very seriously, and she said eventually they had to put a fence around that car. She said, and you could see where he went around the edge of that fence trying to get in. I couldn't believe it. She was mad. I mean, she wasn't even trying to make a joke. Well, anyhow, to see this varmint in a whole new way, to me, was like, you know, a whole new thing. Well, so I rented out that grease, and I started going around the neighborhood. "Now, what about this grease? I got a little, you want a lecture?" Yeah, a number of people took some from me. And they said, "When the children get the croup," but, you know, it seemed like to me, it's like it used as an expectorant. I guess croup, it seems to me, from their description, was sort of like a real phlegmy kind of deposit in the throat. And it seemed like it would work as an expectorant. I actually tried a little this winter when I had a flu, and I can't say if it helped or not, but I've had things that tasted better, I'll tell you that. So So then I asked another one of my mountain buddies. He said, "Oh, bud, I get the rheumatism, gets in my joints. I drink that rear yellow root tea, and bud, I lay that to it." He says, "It's like a penetrating oil. It just works right into them joints. It'll get them flowing." I said, "What about leather?" He says, "Well, I'll make leather soft, but," he says, "don't put it on your boots. It'll make them so soft and tender they get tore up in the dewberry briars." Oh, and you know, so here's like it's like a treatment. He says, "Now I tell you in the wintertime," he says, "I don't take a whole lot of baths, but you know, about once a week. But I tell you, when I'm going to have to go out hunting and be out in the weather all day, or if I'm going to be out gathering wood all day and it's cold," he says, "what I do," he says, "I just get inside that fire, get me a bath, and just get good and hot till I'm just pink as can be. And I just rub that groundhog grease all over me. But," he says, "I put on my clothes, they slide on smooth as silk." And of course, you know, you've heard of people greasing themselves when they go across the English Channel, when they're swimming the English Channel. And skin conditioners. How many of you use skin conditioners? Yeah, I said, "Like a skin conditioner." He says, "Yeah, that's what it's like, buddy." He says, "You can just stay out there all day, and it's just, you don't get no rash, nothing on the face." And so I kind of got amazed at this, and so I started kind of checking around more stories, and I started finding out. Well, of course, like stretched over a banjo head. So here you got food, you've got a musical instrument, you've got a remedy, and you know all this animal that you think of as a varmint. Well, I ran into a couple of Indians in my travels, and I talked to this. It was a Mohican from up in New York. And I asked him, what about groundhogs? Do you ever use groundhogs for anything? Or do you have any special place for them? He says, "Oh," he says, "they're very special animals." He says, they are our medicine animal. And they live among the plants. And they're nothing but plants. They're made of plants. And they know all the herbs, and we make our medicine drums out of that. Sort of transcended this whole way of looking at a groundhog and think about this as a medicine drum. I talked to another friend, Chippewa Cree from Northern Canada, and I said, "What about groundhogs?" He said, "Oh," he said, they're quite special." He said, "They serve as a link between the Mother Earth and the Father Sky. And they serve, what they do is that they live down within the ground, down within the bowels of the earth. They hibernate, and they spend half their year down deep within the Mother Earth. And then they come forth, and they look towards the sky. They live off the herbs and the medicine plants.